It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Well, Kirk, there is a crazy story out of La Crosse.
You know, if it's a crazy story, it's going to be on the show, right?
That's right.
Criteria. You go down the list. Number one, is it crazy?
Is it crazy?
Yes.
And this one,
let's have it.
This one is. And it's
all right.
It's just very weird. There was a La Crosse County judge, this according to News8000.com, set a $500,000 cash bond on Monday for a man who was involved in a crash with a reported stolen vehicle on Highway 35. Now, that's not that unusual. Timmy Johnson Jr., 25, faces several charges, including reckless endangerment, fleeing officers, and bail jumping. This is the part where it gets scary. Authorities found 79-year-old Merle Forbes in the trunk of the stolen vehicle.
Was that the bail jumping part? You're not supposed to drive around with a dead body in the trunk?
No. I believe he had another charge.
Pending.
Yes. And this says, early indications from preliminary autopsies show that the injuries from the assault are leaning towards the cause of death. La Crosse police said Johnson was driving the stolen car when police tried pulling him over. Johnson then led them on a chase that ended when Johnson hit another vehicle and rolled on Highway 35 near Holman. Forbes was pronounced dead on the scene. He was the owner of the stolen vehicle. The investigation into the death is being taken over by Grant County. Now, what's interesting about this is that apparently this man had an encounter with the deceased, with the man who died, the 79-year-old man who died. And that was fairly recently, last year. He had stiffed this cab driver, and he's a cab driver, the guy who died, for a $90 cab fare last year.
Okay.
And court records say that Forbes, the cab driver, picked up Johnson in Darlington last August and took him to Boscobel. Johnson allegedly told Forbes that he needed to retrieve the $90 cab fare from an apartment. When he failed to return after 20 minutes, Forbes called the police. And he eventually pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge and was sentenced to 24 days that he had already served in jail. So he had already had an encounter with this guy, didn't pay his cab fare. He got charged as a result of it. Perhaps that's the motive.
So the charge was that he failed to pay the cab fare?
The charge was fraud on a taxi cab operator.
Okay, yeah.
And so, you know, there's a lot of people who don't think that that's an actual criminal charge.
Oh, sure.
But it is.
Yeah.
And so if you obtained any transportation service from a taxi cab operator and you intentionally abscond without paying for the service, you can be charged criminally. And you often are charged criminally.
What about when the cab driver drives off with your luggage? That happened to me once.
Oh.
I was going on a TDY trip, you know, a temporary duty trip.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I decided to wear the goofiest non-military clothes that existed. This is in the 90s, and it was like grunge era, so I had like the ripped-up jeans and the flannel
sure.
and all that stuff. I hadn't shaved, all this other stuff, so I'm looking all grungy. And all my uniforms and hygiene equipment were in my luggage, and the cab driver just took off. So I had to attend.
Intentionally,
I don't think he did intentionally, I think. But, you know, it was in Montgomery, Alabama, and I had no way of tracking the guy down because it was just a yellow cab. That's all I knew.
Yeah.
And the guy's name was John or something. That was all I knew.
Wow.
So I attended a military operations law seminar. You know, dressed as Kurt Cobain, basically. It didn't go over so well.
I had to explain. Kurt Cobain?
I had to explain to everybody that I was sans luggage. But
that's
very
tough.
Uncomfortable. You know, when the general enters the room and everybody stands at attention, and I'm wearing like
you paid him, right?
I paid the cab driver. Yeah, he just forgot to give me the luggage.
He just forgot.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So it ended up back in St. Louis, like, you know, 2 weeks later. But.
Oh, well, that's not fun. I mean, I think, you know, obviously your situation is much different from this one, but he...
But I would have had a motive if later I was found driving around with him in my trunk. Yeah, that would have been... Yeah,
that would have been a motive. And I think in this situation, it looks like there's a clear motive. Now, this guy was released from jail. The accused was released from jail, day or the day before.
You know, we got to read between the lines here. How does somebody end up spending 24 days in jail time served for a misdemeanor?
I don't know.
That's unusual.
That's interesting.
Because if it's a misdemeanor over a dispute that involved $90 and it involved a guy not coming out after 20 minutes and the police come, and well, obviously he got taken into custody right away. It took 24 days for the case to get resolved in whatever manner, so he must have had some other thing going on.
I think there was another charge, but I'm not positive on that. And you know, the story just gets even crazier. I guess Merle Forbes, the deceased, is also the father of Curtis Forbes, who is currently serving time for a 1980 homicide. It just gets stranger and stranger. I mean, wow. Homicide is not that common.
Right.
And so now you've got two situations where it involves homicide. And this cab driver, or I should say, Timmy Johnson Jr. was reported missing. The cab driver is reported missing and endangered from Platteville. And the police somehow were able to find Timmy Johnson Jr. Now, I don't know exactly how they were able to find. It's not clear
connection.
From the story.
Wow.
But
this should be a movie, or it should be on an episode of one of those crime shows.
Yeah. I mean, there's apparently been some big investigation that's been ongoing, but we have yet to find out what the details of that investigation are. But this seems to be a very unusual situation. They say that his car reached nearly 115 miles per hour before crashing into another car. And by the way, there were a couple of people who suffered very serious injuries from that crash. So he's now in custody and is facing a lot of time.
I would say.
A lot of time.
Well, so, and he's a suspect in the murder as well.
He
I'm
is.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely, he is. So there's another very strange situation. There was a concealed carry situation that happened in Jefferson County, or I guess in Jefferson. A recent day at the Jefferson County Dog Park turned into more than one dog owner bargained for when her firearm accidentally discharged. This according to the union staff. According to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, a female at the Jefferson County Dog Park sustained a self-inflicted gunshot wound when she unintentionally fired her handgun on May 11th. Jefferson County Corporation Counsel Phil Rousteau said during Monday's meeting, and this was a couple of Mondays ago, of the County Parks Committee, that the woman has a Wisconsin concealed carry permit allowing her to legally carry the gun on county park property. She fired the weapon while attempting to tuck it back into her belt, he noted. The bullet injured her buttock. They use
buttock.
One.
The
buttock,
singular.
Yes, the singular. And she was treated for the wound at an area hospital. No other people or dogs were injured. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Office was notified of the incident and has been investigating what charges might be appropriate. The county is unable to restrict patrons from legally carrying concealed weapons in county parks, but discharging the weapons in county parks.
Well, one would assume it's intentional.
Thing.
I mean, isn't it the same as dropping the gun and it goes off? Or, you know, you're looking for your Mentos in your pocket and you accidentally pull the trigger?
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Well, it's so an accidental thing, right?
Right.
And so, excuse me, my
now,
view on this
part of getting a concealed carry permit is that don't you have to take like a quiz or something, you know?
Yeah, I think it's fairly minimal.
Yeah, and like
minimal training.
Should you shoot yourself with your own gun? A, yes. B, no.
No.
C, so I don't know.
No would be the correct answer.
Yes,
in that,
and if she passed that test, one would assume that she knew that she shouldn't. You should. Don't they have? They have safety locks on like every gun.
Yeah, I don't know how this. I don't know how this happened exactly. But you know, the obvious question is what could happen to this woman, and could she be charged? You know, I was looking at a bunch of different potential charges in the situation.
I knew you would.
And disorderly conduct is one of them that theoretically may apply, but she has to tend to cause or provoke a disturbance. And if she's just disturbing
herself,
or the bunny rabbits that are around, or you know,
the dogs.
The fish or the dog, right?
Well, let's say all the dogs start barking as a result of the discharge.
Well,
of
sure,
the
that could.
Would also be disturbing to see some lady shoot herself in the buttock, and then she presumably made a noise.
But this is
it would
one
be
those,
loud and boisterous.
Yeah, but this is one of those. I don't think there was anybody around. So if a tree falls in the forest, you know, it's that situation.
Oh yeah.
And do you charge her? And I think the answer is no.
Well, what about negligent handling of a weapon? Because you're supposed to handle it in such a way that it doesn't go off.
Yeah.
And regardless of whether it hurts somebody or hits somebody.
Right.
I know you probably researched this as well, but another thought that comes to mind is recklessly endangering safety.
That's right.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't want to.
No, no, no.
I don't want to steal your thunder.
I don't own the thunder. You
okay.
get the thunder,
all right,
too.
All right.
So, no, that's
I can share the thunder.
I don't know. Boy, we've been hearing a lot of it recently in Sheboygan. endangering safety by use of a dangerous weapon.
Sure.
Clearly. Potentially recklessly endangering safety. But I don't know. I mean, because endangering safety, if you endanger another safety by the negligent operation of handling a dangerous weapon, that's what you're talking about. You're saying this was negligent, perhaps.
Yes.
Could be negligent.
Sure.
In the situation. But sometimes mistakes are just mistakes, and we don't need to necessarily punish them.
But the law requires that there be a heightened duty of care when you're handling something that's dangerous.
Well, that's true.
Let's say you're walking around with some, sarin poison or something like that, and you drop it because you got butterfingers. You know, well, you're supposed to take extra special precautions when you're handling something that's dangerous. So, that's where I think. But there's another interesting facet of recklessly endangering the safety of another. I believe under the elements, you have to actually. Another person has to actually be at risk of death or great bodily harm.
It has to be another safety. You have to recklessly endanger another person's
safety. It can't be imaginary.
That's right.
It can't be just like theoretical.
And it can't be a bunny rabbit or a, whatever.
Recklessly endangering safety of a bunny rabbit. That would be one. That I don't know if that is a law.
I don't think that's a law yet. But all right. Well, we do have to take a break. I mean, I think she got enough punishment out of shooting herself in the
buttock. Yeah, and from our show, too. I mean, I'm sure she's humiliated if she's listening.
That's right. All right.
Sorry, lady. Sorry.
All right. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. We are really love you and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. I know you talked about on the show last week when you graciously did the show.
Yes.
Solo.
I wanted you to have a nice vacation.
And I appreciated that.
And I understand that you worked throughout your vacation.
Well, I have to admit that's true.
Contrary to my direction.
I know.
That's all right.
I know. I did have some fun, too.
Good. So. You got to have fun.
That's right. Well, I know you did a great job because I heard the show covering this last week. And again, I don't want to steal your thunder, which I'm not trying to do. But actually, this week, J.B. Van Hollen, the Attorney General, and if you know about this story, that you probably do, because you probably heard Kirk talking about it and many other people talking about it. But the J.B. Van Hollen, at least it seemed like, although he's denying this now, was saying that county clerks could be criminally charged if they issued marriage licenses to gay couples.
Right.
And what happened recently, over the past week, is that Judge Barbara Crabb had initially said, essentially this is unconstitutional. You have to allow, gay couples to get married and to have the same rights as heterosexual couples. Then she stayed her own ruling.
Well, my understanding of the procedure is that she issued a ruling that discussed the constitutionality of the subject without a specific remedy involved. And in fact, she'd invited the petitioners to supplement their request with what exactly would make it meet the constitutional standard, understanding what the parameters were. It's some interesting insight as to what happened over the course of the next however many days it was, 10 days or whatever it was, where she said, by the way, I'm staying any implementation of this, because she never did say that it's being implemented in the original decision. So that resulted in the clerks stopping the issuing of marriage licenses. So now the issue is all the people that got married during that time period, is it – what's the future
is
of
it
those
legal?
Marriages?
Right. And this happened in California as well.
Yeah.
With one of their propositions, but there were lots of different county clerk's offices. In fact, most county clerk's offices around the state of Wisconsin issued marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples, but a few didn't. But the controversy was how to interpret that, and when J.B. Van Hollen came out, he was talking about how he's defending the Wisconsin Constitution. And this is from the Journal Sentinel. And the title is Why I'm Defending Wisconsin's Constitution. And he writes, when I took the job of Attorney General 7.5 years ago, I swore an oath to discharge the duties of my office faithfully and impartially and to the best of my ability. The most important duty of Wisconsin's...
Like every oath for every office.
That's right. Yeah. The most important duty of Wisconsin's Attorney General is to defend our state laws and Constitution. He goes on to say the Constitution, our laws, and Wisconsin's very sovereignty cannot defend themselves without someone to stand up to them, to enforce them and defend them. Our laws aren't even worth the paper on which they're written. In Wisconsin, that's the duty of my office. You can see the chaos that reigns in regions throughout the world where the law has no defender. Wisconsin was one of many states during the last decade to ban same-sex marriage. The people voted for it, and it became part of our Constitution. Current polls, however, suggest that people have changed their minds and probably won't vote for such a ban if a referendum were held today. So many politicians, citizens, and commentators from the left and the right have urged me to give up the fight. You're on the wrong side of history. It's a political loser to defend this ban. People have changed their minds. Loss is inevitable. I emphatically reject these arguments. An attorney general should stand up for the law and defend it. Okay, and he goes on and on.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right? So you get the point. So he's talking about, well...
It's on paper, so it matters.
It's on paper. I have to defend it. It's in the Constitution. I have to defend it.
Isn't it the same analysis, essentially, that Judge Crabb went through, though? I mean, she has to consider the same things.
Right, right. You know, and that's the thing, is she considered
it was by referendum. It was voted on by the people, and you know, but... Can you have conflicting provisions in a constitution is the point. And what's the overarching considerations, you know?
Right. And is this something – I mean, when Judge Crabb made her initial ruling and she essentially said this is unconstitutional, what's happening, and not allowing certain people to get married but other people can get married, many county clerks interpreted that as allowing
gay marriage. County clerks.
Most county clerks interpreted that. J.B. Van Hollen had either a different interpretation or thought it was just too soon to decide because there was an appeal pending.
Right.
And so he said, well, we're not going to do this. And while you can understand perhaps his argument, the overarching theme of this is, should we be voting on things like this when we're talking about marriage rights? Is that something that we ought to be voting on or not?
I think the best analogy is that if you were in, you know, Mississippi in 1963 or 64, and you had a popular vote as to whether or not all races should have the same rights, you don't put that to a popular vote because there are federal protections and constitutional protections of people's basic right to enjoy life.
That's right.
And there are certain things that, you know, that's why federal laws and the federal constitution that has those guarantees exist to begin with, is that it sets the standard, and then the states have to, they can do whatever they want in terms of laws that don't conflict with the basic guarantees that we all have.
And the question is, what role, I mean, really, should government be involved in marriage? I mean, is this something that our government should get involved in? Because you have lots of different people who have different views on marriage, right? Some people believe in gay marriage. Other people think, you know, they don't believe in it. And should government even be involved in making that determination as to who gets to get married and who doesn't?
I don't buy this argument, but I've heard it many times. You know, government is already involved in the matters of procreation. When someone's born, they have a birth certificate that's issued by a government agency. You get a social security number. I mean, your life becomes something that's part of the regulatory structure. I mean, you have to, when you're 18, you have to register for the draft, you know. So there are aspects of your life that the government does have some role in terms of at least keeping track of you, you know,
right.
if not, that sort of thing. But we also do have laws that most people don't object to. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but, you know, polygamy, for example, is illegal in all states, including Utah. You know, people think that it isn't illegal in Utah, but it is, you know, and we have other aspects of regulation that are, you know, that do have to do with a person's individual life choices. If somebody ascribes to a religion that involves human sacrifice, well, we don't just let people do that because it's their choice of life. Now, I don't believe this, but I've heard the argument that since the procreation and the issuance of children, as it were, a child issued from her loins, however they say it in that archaic language. But since children and the basic expansion of our population was one of those things that the Constitution was originally designed to protect because of the fact that we should all live and procreate in happiness and blah, blah, blah. Well, there is that view that marriage is tied to that process, and therefore the government has a role in protecting that. Now, my personal view is, what does that have to do? Why would it be that specific? Because it's not required that when a man and a woman are married that they make children.
Absolutely, that isn't required.
That's
right.
You know,
that's right.
And one would think that based on that argument that it is in some way like mandatory. You know, let's have your 2.5 kids. Come on, get on with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other side of the argument that really doesn't make any sense to me is that even if there is a popular view, even if a lot of people, and I don't think that's true anymore, but even if a lot of people did find it something that they themselves would not engage in, how can you have a law where your own personal choice is cast upon other people?
That's right.
And that's the odd thing about it. I mean, that sounds like... And this is also something that is a matter of personal choice and personal happiness that bleeds over into all these other areas, such as what kind of music do you listen to? What kind of clothes do you wear? How long is your hair? You know, do you have tattoos or not? And I'm not saying, you know, that we have a basic fundamental principle in our society that you're entitled to go about your business and do what you're going to do. And, you know, you can be peaceful and be responsible and be happy. And we all have a right to live within the law.
Right.
I mean, I always say this, but that's one very positive role that the law plays, is it gives us those parameters within which we can live. And how would it feel to be in love with somebody who is the same sex as you, and to have society tell you that honest, virtuous thing, you know, to be in love. I mean, what is wrong with that? Every love song written is about that, you know? Every poem about, you know, love and life, it's about that concept. And it's the thing that makes it so when we get up in the morning, we want to live and not die.
And I think that's probably why you're seeing such a shifting tide on this particular issue. And when it comes to constitutional issues, it always gets very dicey, it seems, when you put that up to a referendum, because it leads to situations like this where, you know, the argument is that everybody should be allowed to marry, and we've had evolving views on this particular issue over the past even 5 years. And now J.B. Van Hollen is saying, well, I'm just defending Wisconsin's constitution, and is that a good enough argument anymore? We'll follow this story, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear.
All right, Kirk. So I know you talked about this last week, but we also have continuing coverage on the...
Continuing coverage.
Ken Kratz...
Update.
...situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
And continues to evolve.
That's right. This was an article from the Journal Sentinel. State Supreme Court Justice seeks review of attorney discipline system. So Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson cited three lawyer discipline cases, including one involving former Calumet County District Attorney Ken Kratz, Friday to reiterate a call for an intensive review of the state's attorney discipline system. She wrote, the lawyer regulatory system in effect now was instituted about 15 years ago. It's time to examine it to determine whether revisions are needed. Now, as the backstory on this case with Ken Kratz is many people probably know. There were allegations that I guess he was essentially admitted to many of them, sending inappropriate text messages to one female victim of a
Case that he was prosecuting.
Right. As well as making certain inappropriate comments to other women, I believe, around the courthouse. And so there was basically this whole criticism erupted in 2010 after Mr. Kratz, initially the OLR decided not to really do anything, is my understanding of it.
Right, right.
And then an Associated Press reporter reported on this and found out some things about this particular case and essentially went to the Office of Lawyer Regulation, OLR, and said, hey, you know, what's going on with this situation with this guy, Ken Kratz?
And when it became more public.
Right.
And there was a lot more
heat.
Heat, exactly. Yeah. The OLR sort of changed their position. But I will say, my understanding of how things developed is that they didn't have a complete understanding of what the allegations really were.
Sure.
And perhaps this is something that is properly pointed out by Chief Justice Abrahamson, that the way that the process transpired appears to be somewhat haphazard and without full understanding of what happened. But just the history of it is that Kratz self-reported, so to speak, in his own language, and he had control over the information and said, this is what the allegations are. I am asking to, you know, resign as district attorney. And he quit being a member of the victim advocacy board that he was on. And he withdrew from cases he was prosecuting, et cetera, et cetera. And he portrayed it in such a way that it seemed very benign, you know. And he was alluding to particular problems that he was having in his life at the time involving addiction to prescription medication and a sex addiction that he wanted to seek treatment for. So they decided not to take any action. But that was before there were other allegations that he actually raped somebody, which was not ever prosecuted and not ever
substantiated
right. And did not become a basis for the discipline that was recently handed down. But one has to wonder that if that was the tipping point that made it so the OLR was going to actually proceed with a complaint because it was something that they threw into the mix and then took out of the mix.
Well, and so they've ordered Mr. Kratz to pay approximately $24,000 in costs. Basically based on this whole investigation and based on what happened, and they've suspended his license for 4 months. Now, some are saying, well, okay, that's not long enough. 4 months is a short period of time. And some are saying, well, that's plenty long. In fact, what happened in the Supreme Court always reviews these types of things and they go through it. And Justice Prosser actually dissented in part from the majority opinion, and the gist of his argument that I gathered from it was basically, you know, listen, for him to pay back this entire amount, $24,000, when
He tried to accept responsibility,
and some of these allegations, such as this sexual assault allegation, which was implied, there's really no evidence that that happened, or at least, at the very least, it was unsubstantiated. So why should he have to pay for this long of an investigation? Plus, it happened over the course of several years. I mean, the investigation was from, I believe, 2010, with the events happening in 2009, and this just came out last week in 2014. So, you know, should he really be responsible for paying that amount of
time? And I agree with his position that if the reason that this took so long and the reason that it was so hotly contested is because there were additional allegations that simply didn't occur or could not be substantiated, and that was the one component that made this drag on. And if ultimately that never was part of the scenario, at least in terms of the ultimate discipline, is Kratz then required to pay $24,000 because he successfully defended himself against part of these allegations? I get that argument. I understand what right. Prosser is saying. And to what we do in the OLR is that when somebody is alleged to have done something wrong, there is a basic premise that when one admits to the misconduct, and makes it so you don't have to have all these long, drawn-out hearings. And one has the right, basically, to stipulate to what occurred and to take responsibility for it and then minimize the costs that are involved. And this is one where that didn't happen, and one has to wonder why it didn't happen. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the majority opinion, the gist of it is that he proposed his own discipline, which is I've suffered enough type thing, and he had to choose his own punishment, that sort of thing.
And they seem to suggest that he didn't take responsibility.
Correct. And that was based in part on the wording of his responses, his consistent tendency, which still pervaded through this entire process of aggrandizing his own role in society and falling back on that. That's what he did initially. He said, look, you know, I'm better than you. I'm better than everybody is what it sounded like.
Well, it was like, I'm a very popular prosecutor.
How dare you accuse me of these type things? And although he retracted from that significantly and did end up admitting that these texts, for example, did occur and that he did engage in this conduct, he fell back to, well, you know, I, like everybody else, am a human being and have problems and I would like to get treatment for it, and I understand that there were issues with me, and I was taking painkillers at the time, and I was addicted to all.
And he had just gone through a divorce, I believe, and it was having a rough time.
Yeah, like everybody. So, you know, he admitted that he had the inability to conform his conduct to the standards that are consistent with his office, but at the same time, he kept on touting his accomplishments that he had accumulated over the years in such a way that he wore them as badges and almost like a shield against this type of thing. So that did pervade throughout the proceedings because of the way that he, and it was a more of a tone type thing. But let's get back to what Abrahamson is saying. She's suggesting that, you know, in a series of these lawyer discipline cases, there has been sort of chaos as it leads to the ultimate disposition of it.
Well, and she's saying that the cases raise issues about how regulators use their resources and the extent to which the OLR should consider, quote, mercy, forgiveness, and the wishes of the victims, end quote, in making decisions on whether to prosecute attorneys. She says this matter should be discussed by the court in open conference, not behind closed doors. It's of great importance to the court, the lawyers of the state, and the public. And so there's not necessarily specifics, at least in this article, as to what's being proposed, but just the fact that, you know, these cases take, on average, I believe, 400 days.
Yeah, and that's another problem, because if it's something where, like in this case, it was abundantly clear that some form of discipline was going to result. The question is how long. So right. Over the course of, and this one took more than 400 days.
Yes.
But over the course of at least a year, that attorney's still practicing in most cases, unless they are temporarily suspended because it's such a great problem.
But isn't this the whole concept of, you know, I know it's not a court system, it's right. Not a criminal system, but isn't this the whole presumption of innocence?
No, it isn't, because it's regulatory. Just like
I understand it's different than but when you have conduct that is alleged to have occurred, I mean, anybody can make an allegation, right? We know that.
Sure.
And so the attorneys should be afforded some measure of due process. No?
Right. And there is due process, and people don't tend to lose their licenses while an investigation is occurring. But that can happen if the indication is something, let's say medical incapacitation or mental incapacitation.
Sure.
That's something where the OLR pretty much, you know, immediately takes action to say, look, you shouldn't be practicing law, so please don't. Or just don't. Or in the case where somebody's failed to comply with their continuing legal education requirements, or the most prominent reason for suspension of licenses, failure to pay your bar dues. Well, I mean, if that happens, boom, you can't practice law until they figure out if you did or didn't. And if you didn't, it's pretty easy to tell if you didn't.
That would be a very important thing. All right. Well, we do have to take another break. You're listening to The Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Hello. Is there anybody in there? Just not if you can hear me. Is there anyone home? Come on down. I hear you breathing down. Well, I can ease your pain.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I am Kirk.
All right, Kirk.
Final segment already.
Absolutely. The time flies, and there is a former nurse at UW Hospital that's facing scores, literally scores of criminal charges, for allegedly stealing pain medication from patients. This from the Wisconsin State Journal. Stephanie Jones, 31 years old, was recently arrested after police said that she took syringes of morphine and hydromorphone meant for patients at the hospital on more than 40 occasions between October and March. Jones would allegedly fill the syringes with, quote, water or another unknown liquid, end quote, after stealing the morphine. It's unclear how many patients were affected by her actions. It's also unclear if any patients were harmed, but according to the story, any situation where patients do not receive the pain medication they require is unacceptable to us, a hospital spokesperson said. They said that Jones told investigators that she took the drugs for her own personal use. There's not been any indication that she used the drugs while she worked, and it was said that there were no reports that she was impaired while on the job. But police are recommending 84 charges against Jones, 42 each of diverting drugs and reckless injury. So this is a big situation that's going on right now. And in fact, this isn't all that unusual of a situation, at least as it regards.
It isn't, in the sense that when you have people that are around controlled substances that are that make you feel good and also are addictive, you know, this sort of thing happens. But, you know, most facilities, and it's certainly the case in a hospital, you'd never have a situation where somebody's being administered morphine, you know, alone in the room with the patient. It's very easy, in fact, to have a protocol whereby the controlled substance is controlled under lock and key, and that anytime it's accessed, there's a witness, and that when there's extra, that's the main way that I've seen this occur, is that one can, you know, there's a bit of a margin of error for how much morphine is drawn from the bottle and then used. And that can accumulate over time and create enough of a dose that no one's going to miss it. And but that's why when that procedure occurs, there is usually a witness. There's paperwork that goes along with it. And it's difficult to swap out, you know, an entire syringe full of a controlled substances. But I think in some of these homes, some of these elder care facilities, and some of these other places where people are, you know, sometimes it's where they're terminal and that kind of thing, or hospice or whatever, especially in a hospice situation, I can see this occurring, or home care. You know, yeah, it is a terrible thing to think of, that if somebody is supposed to be receiving a dose of medication because the person requires it, and it's been prescribed,
or whatever the case,
and then they're just getting water, that would be bad. That would be real bad.
Yeah, and that's a very scary situation to think about. And unfortunately, some facilities, I don't know what happened exactly at UW Hospital. I mean, I've been to UW Hospital many times, and it seems like a wonderful facility, but I don't know what happened here.
Sure.
And the story isn't really clear. It says that Jones, according to, I believe, a spokesperson from the hospital, Jones used a quote-unquote loophole previously not identified. She wouldn't elaborate, saying the hospital doesn't want to provide directions to others intent on diverting drugs.
Right.
The hospital notified the State Board of Nursing and U.S.
Well, I hope I didn't just expose it with my theory before.
No, I don't think you did. the Board of Nursing and U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration about the theft, and they've intensified scrutiny of medication handling. But the reality remains that there are many different facilities that you and I have seen in the course of our investigations into you know, defending our clients that are accused of these things, where there just aren't proper safeguards in place,
right.
and that can lead to a lot of different things, especially when somebody is accused of such
type of thing. And as always, there are other people in the facility that have the same access to the substances as other people, and if it's a loose enough system whereby one would have the ability to, you know, take some of these things without it being noticed, well, that applies to everybody who works there.
Every single person. Yeah, and you and I have personally seen situations where a person has been in a facility such as this, whether it be a hospital, assisted living, or whatever the case may be, and they've been accused of stealing medication because they happened to work on the date when it was reported, not necessarily the date that it actually occurred, but the date that it was reported, and you know, through the investigation, it was just determined that, well, this person must have been the person who have stolen it, who must have stolen it. But when we look further into that, there are so few safeguards put in place that anybody could be in that.
But I think when people hear about this kind of thing, a lot of people are surprised to find that healthcare workers are susceptible to the same
addiction
temptations that everybody else is. And just because you work in the healthcare industry doesn't mean that you don't have the same sort of potential problems that anybody would have. But, you know, it raises another issue that is such a hot topic in our society right now, and that is, you know, how do we effectively deal with addiction? Because we've been trying to do that in so many different ways. There are a lot of creative minds and a lot of people that have degrees in counseling. We have psychiatrists, psychologists, court systems that provide opportunities for people to get treatment. It's become such a major driving force behind the interaction between our criminal justice system and people legitimately needing help. And we run into this area where it's so difficult to place our resources appropriately because, you know, I was just in a courthouse in a different county yesterday, and they have a drug court program there, and it's a big sign in the hallway, and you have to wonder, well, if you're a drug addict, what are you doing walking around in the hallways of, you know, the courthouse, you know, unless you're already in trouble, okay?
Right.
And it talks about how it gives a big list of resources that are available if you need help, what the benefits can be if you do have a pending charge, what could result if you participate in these programs. And I think it's wonderful that they have an opportunity for diversion in these types of things, and also an incentive for somebody to want to get the treatment because, you know, sometimes it does take getting caught and having the risk of permanent legal consequences that motivates somebody to examine their own behavior and to seek the help that they need. But that's part of the problem is that it's highly illegal to possess something like heroin, okay? That's a felony no matter how you look at it, even if it's for personal use. And we brand felonies or felons as those that are the worst of the worst, okay? Because we have ordinances, we have misdemeanors at a higher level, and then the highest is felons, where you can't vote, you can't possess a firearm, you are branded in society as one who is a felon because
right.
you engaged in felonious conduct, et cetera, et cetera. So by being in a situation where if you are addicted to heroin, for example, every day that you're in possession of that substance and every day that you're using it, you're committing a felony. At the same time, we want to give amnesty, so to speak, to somebody who's willing to and is actively seeking help. So we kind of say, oh, I know that every day you're doing this, you're engaging in a very serious crime, but we want you to tell us about it so that we can help you. And that's part of why, you know, drug courts are a little controversial in the sense that the way that they work typically in most counties is that a person has to come clean, waive all their rights, usually enter a plea of guilty to whatever felony they're facing. And then in exchange for all of that, because, you know, the prosecutor doesn't want to do the work associated with the conviction and doesn't want to have to worry about if there were people's rights violated in the process of gathering evidence or if a person's Miranda rights weren't adequately protected. So all the things that are in the Constitution, remember how we were talking about that in the first part of the show? The right to remain silent, the right to confront witnesses against you, the right to require a jury to prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the prosecutor has to produce evidence that is not only admissible but also meets that burden.
That's right.
Those are all things that if you want to, you can just forget about all that, admit that you've committed a very serious crime, and then engage in treatment. Now, I'm not saying there's anything bad about that. I'm pointing out some of the problems because if we have a situation where somebody is innocent of what they're accused of and it's one of these crimes, we can see and we have seen situations where a person may very well end up in a scenario where they're entering a plea to something that they didn't do because of the great hammer that hangs over their head. And that is a concern that we all have. And I don't think most people involved in the criminal justice system really see it that way. But we do, because that's what we're here for, is to make sure that those rights are protected. And everybody's interested in keeping the rights protected, the judges, the prosecutors, everybody. But the point is that we see it from the person's individual perspective. Getting back to, though, how we address this problem. And You know, opiates in particular are so insidious because of the way that not only do they become physically and chemically and permanently addicted. And, you know, it's one of the sayings that they have at NA meetings, Narcotics Anonymous meetings, is that, you know, if you're an addict, you are an addict and you always will be. You know,
right.
Even if you stop and even if you successfully refrain till the day you die, you are an addict.
That's
and
right.
And it's something that, you know, we have to acknowledge that not only the temptation, but the great need in our society to really, we have to guide young people away from this. And we do have to acknowledge the great efforts that virtually every county in our state, and really it's a nationwide epidemic right now. We're putting a lot of resources and a lot of good thought towards educating people on this sort of thing. So those are things that we hope will continue to work.
Absolutely. And you know, it's one of these situations where you look at it and you go, okay, if you can help people, if we can stem this off at the tide, if we can get in early and help people with addiction issues, we'd probably all be a whole lot better off. So it's something that we'll follow. You've been listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL.